Thanks, Peter. I must say this is coming back for a second year to the Institute and to the Ideas Festival, and to have the pals sitting in the audience is a bit intimidating for an African-American who grew up in Peekskill, New York, who had to deal with all kinds of low expectations that were projected to me. And if it were not for my mother and my father, both of who have recently passed, I would not be standing in front of you today. So what you're going to hear from me, I hope, comes from my struggles as a child growing up in what was called a very racist environment. Peekskill, New York was. It was well known for the Peekskill riots in 1949 when Pete Seeger and Paul Robeson were stoned at the Hollybrook Theater. And I'm certain some of the students I went to school with, their parents wore the white robes. And many, many times when I would run down the hill to the school, to Oakside Elementary School, I can remember how often I was brought to tears by the good intentions of my classmates who would say things to me like, well, you know, God was good to Eric because he had a little white paint left over for him. And that hurt me deeply because the beauty of my family is the beauty of America from the standpoint of the tones of skins and the experiences that we bring to this country. So I hope in my presentation, brief that it is, for about 15 minutes, otherwise Kirsten will be jumping up and down and giving me the high sign, because we did not have enough time for questions last year, so we want to have an exchange. I hope that you hear when my voice rises, because it does, because of the experiences that we have as an organization that's focused on organizing, motivating, and supporting school communities across the country. Right now, the National Urban Alliance, of which I head, is working in 26 districts, but our experiences run the range of urban school systems and suburban school districts in Minneapolis and Chicago and Detroit and San Francisco and New York City and elsewhere. And what we have found consistently is that the child is not included in the education reform equation sufficiently to allow their voices to be heard. Thank you. Thank you. Please do. It will definitely make me relax if you just, you know. And why I say that is because from our experiences, our daily experiences, and we spend more time on the ground than any other national group in the classrooms with our sleeves rolled up, guiding, motivating, cajoling, pursuing educators to begin to believe in the capacity of all children to succeed. And the only way that we can do that, because they just don't believe us, not our children. Well, it worked in Minneapolis, and I'll get into the data later. It worked in Minneapolis, but not in our school district. You know, it will never work here because it's the problem of the kids. It's the problem of the parents. They're just not engaged, and the kids aren't motivated. And when you meet those children and we model and demonstrate for them how they're missing the learning equation that would enable every single child to participate at his or her highest ability level. Virtually all children are capable of graduating from American high school prepared, college ready. Virtually every single child. And I'm not going to repeat some of the things I said, but there is data, and it's informed us. And our work with children who have been labeled, and when they send us down to the basement, and in the basement of a school, invariably, wherever you go across America, our African-American boys have been shut off to the side and put on the label emotionally disturbed. In my state of Connecticut, where I live, they're called intellectually disabled. Or when you go into these communities in the Midwest we're talking about, you know, that we work, and we hear that they decide to build prisons based upon the achievement scores of kids in the second and third grade. And then you begin to see how kids are herded into the prison system. It demands in me, it demands in us, to capture and embrace that voice that has been missing in the American Education Reform Initiative. And it's that passion, that belief that every single child is capable of learning if adults engage with them through mentoring, through leadership, through tutorials, through getting into the home. We have 3.5 million educators in this country. 3.5. Many of them are passionate. Many of them are motivated. But all too many of them are disengaged, have become cynical, skeptical about the ability of their children to succeed. Our job, in some small way, is to model and demonstrate with those kids they don't think can learn, to demonstrate that they indeed can learn, that they can learn the calculus, that they can learn inferential comprehension, that they can get way beyond the basics, that through their culture and through their language and through their experience, you can grab the child and motivate the child. In our work in Denver, where we saw many children struggling and wanting to be, since adults were not there for them, who do they turn to? They turn to gangs. Because everybody is looking for that neighborhood. Everybody is looking for that embrace. And when the adult is not there for them to submit a belief that is driven by a new hope that you transfer to them, that is captured by an advocacy voice that really begins to lift up those children and see them smile and see them succeed and see that ceiling raise in terms of achievement, there is nothing better than that. Nothing better in this universe. So yes, yes, I'm a passionate educator. Thank you. And I also recognize that in that passion comes the need for accountability to those communities. And you're not going to hear us, the superintendent of Newark and I, asking for more money. Because we don't want money to be wasted, and now it's wasted. So much money is wasted in schools. We feel that the focus of education reform has got to be on community building, has got to be on linkages between the home and the school. And the primary focus and where the rubber meets the road is with the American teacher. And yes, that American teacher just happens to be white. That's just it. 70% just happened to be white. That's just a reality. That's not something to turn away from. It's something to run toward and embrace and show them, reignite their passion, their belief that got them so excited about joining the educational force, choosing to be a teacher. But it has to be driven by a new knowledge base. What we see in our work around the country are examples of institutional racism, such as disproportionate numbers of African-American students being labeled in special ed, or the pernicious academic tracking. We go into schools, even integrated schools. They're beautiful. I mean, it's wonderful. Give children an opportunity to be guided, and they learn to work together. And it's not working toward a colorblind society. We should never become colorblind. We should be a colorful society that embraces the hope and the wisdom that has been passed to us by others, that enables us to recognize the importance of schooling in America. Colzo, in his very, 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 very dark book, The Shame of the Nation, The Restoration of Apartheid Schooling in America, has got it right on certain levels and has got it wrong on many other levels. Primarily because I don't think as a country we can ever give up on the needs of children. And when we go into those schools and one corridor is white and the other corridor is all children of color, there's something wrong. Because we know, and those parents who argue for their children being labeled as talented and gifted and the other kids not, are doing a disservice not only to other people's children, but to their own children by isolating them from diversity. So that's going to be a major theme that you hear in my brief statements. Does racism still exist? This morning, I heard someone say, oh, no, this is 1962 rhetoric. Well, maybe you're not in the classroom, or maybe you're not in the school, or maybe you're not in the communities where we work, but we know it is so embedded in the culture of a community, and we have to call it out in a friendly way. Not in a way that causes people to become defensive, but in a way that really brings them toward changes through courageous conversations about racism, through an understanding about what it really is. One of my favorite books of recent reading is Levitt and Dubner's Freakonomics. It was a hot topic last year, if you recall. And I keep on going back to it. And they asked the question, quoting them, how might you determine whether the seemingly lack of discrimination against blacks and women represents a true absence or just a charade about racism? The answer, they go on to say, is in how other groups are not protected as well. For example, they cite the elderly and the Hispanics. And when you think about the issue of immigration, as complex that it may be, it really does boil down to race and power. Race and power. I would look, and I would add and reinforce that we need to begin to look at our schools. Alan Greenspan, and I, what a wonderful man. I can remember one time I jumped off my treadmill because I was watching C-SPAN. That's what I watch. I don't watch shows, reality shows, you know, American Idol or American Midol or American Ego, whatever it might be called. And he said one thing that was so important to a question from an African-American congressman in the hearing that he was attending. And the congressman asked the chairman, why are our children, African-American children, doing so poorly? And to his credit, Alan Greenspan said, it's because of racism, it's because of poverty, and it's because of lack of educational opportunity. The data. Every 9 seconds in America, primarily children of color become dropouts. The increased social stratification in our society. The herding of people into prisons. In my state, 72%. In Connecticut, 72% of the prisoners are people of color. Now, that's wrong, especially when 90% of the children in special ed in the state of Connecticut are African American or Hispanic children. The increasing frustrations among the teachers, and this is where I'm going to wind down. A teacher just called me. She just got me before I came here. And in tears, she said, I heard you talk a year ago, and it took me all this time to get up my courage to give you a call. And so I typed down what she was saying. She said, this is a teacher in Mount Vernon who has been serving there for 30 years in Mount Vernon, New York. She says, it makes me cry when I think what is happening to our kids. The kids I serve are black. I am not. I am white. I'm not even allowed to run free clinics in my school for tutorial services. I have to go to the library because teachers are jealous. Parents are not empowered. I am crying, and she was, as I'm talking with you. Teachers have to be stopped from laziness and inertia that they are embracing. I have a parent getting an attorney out of frustration. There are children's lives I am talking about. I am angry beyond words. Last year, a fourth grade student threatened his life. He told me he didn't have a friend and started to sob, and it was an African-American child. He told me his teachers didn't care about him, and he thought he was going to fail no matter what they did or he tried to do. That is what they told him. It breaks my heart. Too many teachers crush the lives of all too many children. And Claude Steele says it so well when he says that African-American children in particular face a double devaluation that comes out of routine academic failures, which tend to confirm the society's negative stereotype, which is then internalized and becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy for the students, thereby undermining their motivation to learn. Steele calls it the stereotypical threat that some teachers aren't even aware that they're projecting toward children of color or to girls in particular as it relates to mathematics. Malcolm Gladwell, in a wonderful book, Tipping Point, that I know you're all aware of, because we're always trying to look for that strategic intervention that will lead to tipping, has studied juvenile delinquencies in high schools and the dropout rates. And what he has found is that a child is better off in a good neighborhood and a troubled family than he or she is in a troubled neighborhood and a good family. Let me repeat that. A child is better off in a good neighborhood and a troubled family than he or she is in a troubled neighborhood and a good family. Guess what that neighborhood is for the inner city child? It is the school. It is the community. It is the safe haven. I had a lot more things to say, but I'm going to really sum this up by saying what we need to do as a group. And I called out last year, I don't remember, Peter, if you recall, I called out to the civil rights leaders who are in this audience to refine your voice. It doesn't mean marching in the streets anymore, but it means engaging with the school communities and providing the leadership that's necessary, because there is hope. And with hope, children begin to succeed, and their activity and what happens to kids becomes determined, and then people in the community become confident, which is what Marion Bolden will talk about. So we need to mobilize our communities. And that's not that difficult. That is our work. And we have not failed in helping a community think globally and act locally. in the handout that you got on page 30. There's some other examples. We have to engage the community in conversations on racism. We have to demonstrate with students and with the teachers present and the principals there and parents there. We have to provide the tools for the teachers, which we do. If you want more, you can see again in that publication. We have to build the partnerships with unions. And guess what? Unions have never been a problem for us because we respect the teachers. And we provide that opportunity for professionalism that is gained from improved learning and teaching opportunities. Notice I said learning and teaching, not teaching and learning, because it's got to be student focused. We have to lead with knowledge and good data. I can't read the poster boards over there, but just let me give you two examples. In Seattle, where teachers who had at least 2 years of training with us, in comparison with similar demographic groups in Seattle, African Americans, those students who had teachers who were trained for 2+ years doubled the achievement of those students who had teachers who were not trained. Doubled the achievement. And this is what really is exciting for me, because I celebrate our diverse population. I celebrate in the very near future that we as a nation will never point to a minority. Because how can we point to a minority when a new majority are people of color? That means we all are a nation of minorities. And rather than disempowering ourselves by using that label, we should empower us by calling ourselves Americans. And when Barack Obama at the Democratic Convention, and this is, I'm not leaning in one direction or the other, when he said what America needs to be driven by is the audacity of hope, the boldness of hope, that is what we're talking about. When Susan Sontag said that rather than being driven by the pessimism that comes from the intellect, we need to be driven by the optimism of the will. And in communities where we are, insufficient numbers of people have the will. Policymakers have it. Leaders such as the Powells have it. To listen to you. I'm listening to you, if I may use your first name. Your presentation was so impassioned and so hopeful for the model that you're working on in transforming America through the work that you do. So the last example of data that I'm end with and then turn it over to my esteemed colleague is what we found in Minneapolis. In our work with Minneapolis, we're working with 13 districts where students are being bused from Minneapolis to outlying townships. 1,600. We're working with about 30,000 teachers and community and communities about 12. Those students who were bused and integrated, and I'm not saying what the intervening variable is, but I know that it has to do with teacher quality. Teacher quality is at the core. Those students who were part had gains 3 times higher than the students who were remaining in the magnet and the regular schools in Minneapolis. So there's hope. There's hope. And I think that I really will finally end. One of my favorite quotes is by the late Congressman Barbara Jordan, where she pleaded that all, and I'm going to do it, I can't do it the way that she delivered it. But she said, all Americans want an America as good as its promise. All Americans want an America as good as its promise. And I don't want us to run out of time as a nation. I don't want us to give up on any child, because every single child is important life. And let's change the life trajectory of kids by refocusing our attention on what we know does have a positive impact on student achievement. Thank you very, very much.
I'm going to sit here if it's okay with the audience. I don't think they would have a problem with that. The only thing I disagree with is Eric suggesting that we don't need more money. Now, let's be careful how we state certain things. Now, I think we have enough to do the core piece, but I'll talk to you why money becomes very necessary in urban districts. Newark is an urban district, as you know, but I would characterize Newark as a very urban district. Newark is not like San Francisco. Newark is more like Compton. Newark is not like Minneapolis. Newark is more like Detroit. And the issues we have are very, very serious, and we are a district in crisis, but there is a lot of hope in our city because some of the things I think that we have attempted to do. Newark, in terms of its demographics, we have 45,000 youngsters. 57% are African American, about 35% Latino. We have a large Portuguese. We also have Brazilian, so it's diverse. But the per capita income in our city is about $23,000. Most of the households are single family. Our kids struggle every single day, but yet we are still very hopeful. I became superintendent about 7 years ago. But let me go back and let you know that I was born in Newark. I was raised in Newark, chose to teach only in Newark. I rose through the ranks. I became an administrator, and I was recruited by maybe 35 ministers came to my office and asked me to please consider taking on the superintendency in the city. And the only thing that I asked them to do is that when I needed them, would they please be behind me? And I think part of why our story is not as bleak as some might think is because there is a community now that is somewhat supportive of the school district. I was a high school math teacher. I enjoyed teaching, didn't think I'd ever leave the classroom. But when I first became superintendent, I said, I'm going to focus on academics, 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 because that's what it's all about. Well, it only took me a week to realize that I have to do two things concurrently in order to be successful. I went to, and you're going to say, what does this have to do with academics? But I think you'll see the tie-in. Went to a football game, Westside High School, and I was surprised. There was nobody in the stands. I looked at the football team. They were scrawny little kids. They had lost 57 games in a row. It was a record, a state record. And I felt for those kids. And so did their principal, and we got a very dynamic principal. But I looked at what our problem was. There was very little spirit. There was very little hope. There was very little optimism. And so I said, there are things that I have to do and listen to my kids and find out what they want, in addition to making sure I get the right academicians in the classroom. And so that school that I just told you lost 57 games in a row went to the sectional finals of the state last year. And that's a good thing. And when you go to any games, you see that the stands are full. I started with one band, one marching band. I have 12 high schools. I now have 11 marching bands because there's something called spirit and pride and hope and optimism that children need as well. So I listen to my children. And, yes, I go in locker rooms. And my people don't say to me, that's how a locker room is supposed to look. We have respect for children, and I think that they are beginning to recognize that we care about them and we're keeping them. Let me give you a few statistics about, first of all, I had a $23 million deficit when I started. That's why these ministers came to me, I think. We had a graduation rate of 45%. Last year, our graduation rate was 67%. And I don't have the statistics for this graduating year, but I think we will have approached 70%. But there are a lot of things that we put in place in order to keep our kids with us, all kinds of different programs. But I have to do lots of things. And I am a superintendent that gets criticized for a lot of things that she does. I was sitting in this auditorium this morning, and they were talking about the arts. And I don't care what budget crisis we have, I hold sacred my art and my music teachers. I have not cut an art or a music teacher since I've been superintendent. And my art and music teachers worry about that. They said, what's going to happen when you leave? I said, you have to show that having a rich music and art program makes a big difference in the lives of our kids. I was criticized by a foundation, and one of which stopped funding us because I allowed my kids to open their own nightclub. Now, understand what it takes to open, operate, and run a nightclub. And it was not a nightclub it was just showcasing their talent. But what it did, it saved children's lives. I got letters. So I know what it takes in an urban district. And I'm going to get to the academic piece too, because that really is my charge. But we had to show kids that we cared. Now, some of you were perhaps in the presentation with President Clinton, and he said how you get people on board and how you get people to move and believe in themselves is you have to show that you are pulling for them. And that's what we do for our kids. They need to know that there is nothing that you ask for that's unreasonable. There are things that you do that we're going to correct, and we're not going to allow you to be disruptive. But there are lots of things that a community can demonstrate to children that get them to begin to say, I can work harder. Now, I have money to spend. Now, the reason that Eric suggested that we didn't need money, we're an Abbott school district. In New Jersey, there was a court ruling that said in certain school districts, they are going to get additional funds to wipe out disadvantages as much as a school district can. So what has allowed me to do is to engage groups like NUA to help us, to look at our teachers, to see where their deficits are. Because as often as you want to say there are deficits in student learning, there are deficits sometimes in teachers' ability to teach content, pedagogy, and what have you. But we have money to extend our school day. That has been very, very important to us. I mentioned this morning that because of New Jersey's crisis in their budget, I got a letter 2 weeks ago, and the commissioner said, you have to curtail your summer school, and the only summer school programs that you are going to be allowed to run are remedial. That cuts against what we're trying to do. And we fought. And when I called those ministers, and I said, there's no way that enrichment programs in this city, with all of the crime and violence, and we're trying to keep kids off the street and engage them in another way, we were able to reinstitute our summer program. So that was very, very important. When Eric talked about schools becoming a safe haven, I travel all over the country, and the minute I suggest that I am the superintendent of Newark Public Schools, most people feel sorry for me. But that was true when I was a student in Newark. And I said that one of the things that I wanted to do was to change the image of the Newark Public Schools. But what happens is the school district's image is meshed with our politics in our city and everything else. We have operated in Newark as a separate entity. We don't get support from City Hall. I hear what I'm saying. That's not typically the way schools and cities run. Our past mayor, who I have done everything I could to win him over, said, the schools are yours, I have other things to do. That is not true with our new mayor. And I'm hopeful that there will be some real support, because that makes a big difference to kids when they know everybody in the city is supporting what we do. In our city right now, in the last 18 months, I have buried 20 students. It is incredible. And on the plane, the woman sitting next to me said, do you know now that Newark is the number one gang capital? I said, no, I didn't know that. I know that our situation is really in crisis, and their hope is on the way, but I knew this 7 years ago. We tried to tell people, and they didn't hear us. But as hard as that is to accept, it is in the school that our kids feel safe. It has become the safe haven. And our incidents, and I have to go to the New York Times editorial board because they don't get the story right at all. The issue is outside of school. The incidents in Newark went from 751 major incidents in 1999 to 350 last year. That's cut in half. What the problem is, and I listen to my kids, and I told you, students have voices, and you have to listen to what it is that they tell you. It was at Central High School that 1 o'clock, I saw some girls walking in the hall, and I stopped to talk to them, and it was legitimate. But I was talking to them about academics and how they were doing and what class they were going to. And they said, Ms. Boland, don't you know it's 1 o'clock? Most of us aren't thinking about English. We're not thinking about mathematics. We're trying to figure out, how do we get home safe today? Which route do we take? Because these children live right next to Baxter Terrace, and they're notorious for drugs and all kinds of things. And that's, you want to know how a superintendent feels when your children tell you that their issue is they don't feel safe outside of the corridor? So those are issues that we deal with. And so while they're with me, it's an opportunity for me, because they're crying out now saying, provide us with an opportunity to break this cycle of poverty and drugs and killing. I have their attention. When I used to go to the school, they used to tell me, I want a new stadium. You got one. We want new uniforms. You have it. I've given them everything they've asked for. Now they've got to give me what I asked for. And that is for them to focus academically and to do. Someone just asked me, what are you doing for math and science? We had one robotics program. Our children now are involved in robotics. It has done a lot for them in terms of math and science. We have probably one of the two most renowned debate teams in America. Our science high school won the state championship 20 years in a row. So there are things that just are not told about Newark's children. But there are still issues that I have, because I stop now in schools and kids will say to me, Miss Bolden, I've got three teachers that are not teaching. That's a whole different conversation. That's a whole different conversation. But I have to be attentive to that. And I look at them and I said, we're going to make those things better. I still go in classes. And this, I think, is what Eric is alluding to, too. Teachers still do not have high expectations. My children are smart. They're intellectually gifted. And they know it. And they are now demanding that somebody pays attention to them in ways that they deserve. And so, yes, I accept Teach for America teachers in a heartbeat, because they come with high expectations. I said earlier, though, the problem is they stay with us 2 years and then they leave. So we are trying to cultivate a high academic, certainly, but also at the same time balancing what we give our kids in terms of their spirit and hope. And I think we've done a very good job. We do have to convince people that there are certain things that we need. And I don't think they get it. You have to live in the world of children that don't have to understand what little things make such a big difference to them. I spent an hour convincing the commissioner. Now, let me just say this. I would have done it. And if she said no, I would have been insubordinate. But, and it was a weight room. The boys have asked for a weight room. We finally got the money to do it. And for some reason, if it's not tied to academics, we are not going to let you spend money. This is a new governor, new mission. But I met with him a week ago, and I kind of changed his thinking, too. Because, no, you really have to talk to people. And you have to get them to understand what it is that you're doing and why you're asking for what you're asking for. No one wants urban children not to be successful. But you have to understand their world. You can't say that I'm going to lower expectations. You have to raise the bar. But you have to give them the kinds of things that make a difference to them. The superintendent before I got there, and I was never able to convince her, our children could not travel abroad. My kids go all over the place. And it transforms them. They come back, and I tell them I envy you, because I have never been to Spain. I have never been to Italy. I've never been to England. And they tell me that it is just, they said, it's a whole nother world out there. I said, well, I'm glad you're there. See, that's why I told you I still need money. Okay. Because I make them get half of it, and I don't care who I have to call, they get to go. And so there's now this flywheel that we have been pushing, and the momentum is growing and growing. We will be called a failing district by No Child Left Behind, but I'm going to talk to George Bush, and I'm going to convince him too that value added has to be considered, because every year our scores go up, but every 3 years the benchmark goes up. So I am a superintendent who feels privileged to serve her children. I think that we have a lot of work to do, but I invite any of you, if you're driving through or drop in Newark Public Schools, we'd be glad to have you visit, and we'd be glad for a donation.
So, thank you for that. Thank you. Someone stood up, and that's deserved. Thank you very much. Because we have to stand for the kids, and that's what it means. We're open to questions at this point. Go ahead.
I have a question. We were talking earlier about older children.
That was great.
Starting very early, what programs do you have or would you like to have starting prenatal all the way up through 3, through preschool, through K?
You know, I neglected to talk about what we are able to do through additional funding. Prenatal, I don't get involved in. I certainly advocate for that. But we have universal pre-K in the city of Newark. In fact, I am sure that that program, as soon as we got the certified teachers in there, when I started, 33% of our fourth graders were reading at grade level. Now near 70% reading at grade level, and partially because we have a program for 3- and 4-year-olds. And the 4-year-olds who have been involved in pre-K, by the time they got to fourth grade, those were the first group that we tested, and the scores have just been going up. But Newark itself has not done a very good job taking care of our infants.
If I may add to that, I think that early childhood is recognized as having an impact. And yet in our work nationally, we often see the scores that were rising for students who had good early childhood intervention being washed out by the eighth grade. And that, a lot of that from our own research and our own work has laid right at the foot of the door or the classroom of the American teacher, because the attitudes, because of the expectations, they get dashed. And the sad thing is that the teacher doesn't understand that the language they're using very often is disconnected from the experiences of the kids. And when you have a 30 million gap in terms of vocabulary between children who are struggling with poverty and children who are not, you had better spend time on vocabulary enrichment that enables the kid in the context of the work to learn those vocabulary and make up that time. And they will, and they have, dramatically. So thank you for your question.
Over there, Eric.
Is this?
Yes.
Okay. The other day I met somebody here who was learning to become a coach for principals, and she was telling me that there was a very high departure rate for teachers within their first 2 years. And I'm wondering what you do to keep your teachers and principals motivated and energized to stay in the job when things get tough.
It's directed to me. We do have an induction program for new teachers, fairly new program. Our district is broken up into geographic regions, and we have assistant superintendents. Each of them is responsible for a strong induction program for their new teachers. Now, and I have to say that more of our teachers stay, but we do still lose more than I would like to admit. So, I mean, and there are issues. And, you know, when I gave you a statistic about the number of youngsters and the violence is really amongst themselves, it still sometimes troubles teachers. So, you know, teachers, they're human. They want to feel safe in their environment as well. So we've done a lot to encourage teachers to stay. We only last year put money in the budget to have tuition reimbursement. We have staff development. NUA works with our high school teachers. And so it gives them the kind of supports that they need as well. We also have a Striving Readers grant that NUA is going to be working with us as well. Teachers do have opportunities. We give new teachers grants and incentives in that regard. Our principals we don't lose, though, for the most part. They do stay with us almost once they become principals. Once in a while, we get them to losing them to another district because they become an assistant superintendent or something like that. But the issue for us is getting quality teachers and keeping those teachers, because that makes the biggest difference in the world.
For some teachers, we're not sad to see them go. But from the standpoint of our work in Indianapolis, as an example, what we found is that we began to lose teachers to the suburbs based upon one criterion. Have you been part of the NUA training process? Hired. And so we had to stem that flow by creating other incentives through the our advocacy with the Board of Education and the superintendent to get more money added to the teacher's salary. So there is a unique, complex exchange of various forces that we're fighting with. And in Indianapolis, we see high teacher mobility, and we see student mobility of almost 70%. And yet, if teachers are treated professionally, changes can happen. Thank you for your question. Yes, sir.
You can't do it yourself. How do you motivate the parents to help you on this program? And also, the second question, how many of those students that graduate come back and help you in your community?
Okay. The issue of our parental involvement is a struggle. It really is. There's much more parental involvement than there used to be. I have a parent advisory council. But again, what I usually get are the parents who are involved anyway. We have requirements, too, by the state that we are supposed to engage parents. But, I mean, mandating it doesn't help me. You know, I reach out. I put back in place a Channel 22, a public access. Nobody was using it. And I know that I get to my parents that way because I see them in the supermarket. And they say, I know what's going on now because I see it on Channel 22. Many of them can't come in and volunteer their time, but I think that the mere fact that I have more kids graduating suggests to me that even though I don't see the parents, they must be doing something to encourage kids to come, because we put messages out there. We had a parent job fair 2 weeks ago, and I was surprised by the response. And that suggests to parents, too, that you care about them. And we were able to get 62 jobs that day. They weren't high-paid jobs, but the parents were very, very supportive. I think if I had more parental involvement, positive parental involvement, our job would be a lot easier. But in spite of that, I think it's still getting better.
In our work, if we're talking about going to scale, and I think that's what you're alluding to somewhat in your question, we have to model and advocate for the teachers to get out of the school and get into the homes and see the kids there. Because so many parents that we know in inner city are afraid of coming to the school because they've had negative experiences themselves there. But when we can go into the home, and we've done it in Harlem, and often when it's primarily a female teaching staff, we ask a male to go along in certain communities for safety purposes. But when we are able to provide not only the students and the teachers and the parents with the tools, then change happens. In our work in Albany, New York, we're also working with the police force to actually train the officers and becoming much more cognizant about relevant approaches and mediations with students. And what we're beginning to see, which is very exciting, is that the officers are now reaching out. They're feeling better about themselves and are also supporting the parents. So when they were dealing with the problems of violence, it gets dissipated when the child knows that there is an adult mentor, whether it's a police officer, a teacher, a community worker, a social worker, whatever the case may be, an outside program, faith-based leaders, whatever that is, involvement can be improved. And it's not going to happen, and you know this, by sending out notices electronically or paper to parents. You have to reach out to them to make them feel secure. And I got to tell you, the times that I've been in East Harlem, New York, and families, Latino families, where I've had to just learn to like this very sweet coffee that was always given to me. And I hate coffee with sugar. But I did it because they were amazed that I, as a teacher, as an administrator, was willing to come into their homes, into their communities, to support their children.
The second part of it was, do you have any of your students coming back and after graduation and helping you in your program?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I had one young lady who's going to Harvard right now, wants to come back this year. There are 7 or 8 science high school youngsters who are going into all of the summer school classes, encouraging kids to think about higher education, showing them how to fill out applications and things of that nature. But I also have a future teacher scholarship, and tied to that scholarship is that they would come back and teach in the district. Now, I put that as part of the requirement of the scholarship, but I know full well that if they don't want to come back, they don't have to. But we've got three. This is the first group that would be coming back, and we have three applicants who are going to come back and teach in the city.
Thank you. Yes.
Hi. I second your opinion about home visits as a teacher. I found them very effective. My question has to do with English learners. I'm wondering what you think are the best policies or programs that you've seen that have been most effective with students learning English.
We use the exact same programs that we use for our English-speaking children, and we adapt the material to it. Now, we have a conflict within our own district in terms of how long a child should be in ELL. I have an assistant superintendent who thinks that we need to get kids out of the bilingual program as quickly as possible, and I have a bilingual director who says that you absolutely can't do that and put children in positions where they're not able to learn. So we use the traditional second language materials that any other school district does. I don't know if that really answers your question.
Well, we have to talk. That's one area that we haven't talked. What we found with, and I lived for a couple years in Mexico, and what we found in the work is that the most important thing for ELL students or ESL students is to engage them in a dialogue and a conversation that builds out of respect about their language but does not penalize them for using a particular word. But recognizing that these children, because they have an accent or because they're not able to speak English well or as bright as any other child, it is our job as educators to find what turns those kids on. And so what we found is highly successful with that population is engaging them in conversation. And this is really key. Engaging them when you're dealing with reading and reading comprehension as a first step, not necessarily the vocabulary, but the reading comprehension, and enabling those kids and those time to work with kids who are fluent in the English language and impairing them, because you break down those walls of academic tracking and you're able to bring kids together. And who benefits the most from that exchange? It's the tutor, not the 2D. But we're finding that when we are focused on high language experiences for the kids that are in the context of the real world, as Paulo Freire taught us so well, that if you start with the language and the experience of the child, that cultural experience where it becomes relevant for him or her, learning is accelerated dramatically. If you come at it from the standpoint of asking the kids to tell words, recall, and talk in that sing-song approach, where they're being asked to deal with contractions and stuff like that has no contextual formulations around the use of it. So I hope that answered your question. Yes.
The gains in our ELL program, though, they must be doing it right because they're achieving higher than the general ed students. In other words, the gains are higher in the program.
And part of that has to do with the fact that what we found with ELL students is that the families are often intact. The mother and father are
absolutely
there. And it's for that child who is dependent on the school because the parent is not there. That is our biggest concern. Yes, sir.
Okay, question that I've got, because when you were giving your opening remarks, you know, you're trying to get these people to reach their highest ability. Another word that I'd like you to see you include, which will lead on to another little something, is to their best ability, because everybody has their own little something that they've got, their gift that they can bring. And with that thought, have you tried to develop vocational and technical programs at the high school level and develop skill assessments to see if some of the students would be worth going into these programs and then have them lead on into college technical programs or vocational school programs? You know, I'm preparing some of these students for that route.
It's an excellent question, and there's nothing more appropriate than vocational or occupational subjects. And yet, what we're finding in our work is that to be a good auto mechanic now, you have to have at least the first year reading comprehension level. And so what we often do in vocational ed is dumb things down. And what we're saying is that you can't dumb it down, because primarily if they're going to succeed in this vocation or this job, they have better know how to work in a team, to be respectful of authority, to come on time, to engage in the kinds of higher order intellectual performances that are demanded of the kids in advanced placement programs. Because that is where you boil it down. I just want to add one other thing. I was informed about the capacity of children. I rail. I get so sick to my stomach when I read Dan Seligman writing Forbes magazine in December 2005. You know, a primary article where he said, we have just got to quit raising the aspirations of the poor children who are struggling with poverty because they just don't have the intellectual ability. And then you go to page 526 in The Bell Curve, written by Charles Murray, who's part of AEI. And you see him say to you, to the reader, and I read these things very carefully, that what we need to do is create Indian-type reservations, 526, go check it out, Indian-type reservations for children who are challenged by poverty so that we, American, can go about its business and not have to worry about the quote-unquote minorities because they lack that ability. And why I'm informed by that and get impassioned is because one of our heroes is a cognitive psychologist from Israel. One of his students had Down syndrome, reported IQ of 70. That child now is a medical doctor with reported IQ. And so I said this to Chris Shays, and he said, you mean, Congressman Shays? And he said, you mean someone graduated from a medical college with an IQ of 70? And I said, that's the point. What we're learning from brain-based research, what we're learning from brain imaging, is that what we're learning from the operations to control epilepsy, that when the brain can regenerate cells and develop bilaterality again when the left hemisphere has been removed, you know, don't tell me you know the capacity of a child based upon his or her skin color or whether or not they're challenged by poverty. So I use that as a way of getting at a point that I wanted
to
make.
I mean, it's just because, the science that goes into, vehicles, computer programming and everything now for repair work is far beyond what it was 20 years
ago. Exactly correct.
And that's, raising the bar for these kids, but, giving them alternative avenues, instead of seeing them drop out.
So formulaic intelligence is good for bookkeepers. That's great.
All right, let me get into some Eric's take. Let me just say, in terms of the 12 high schools that we have, it is one of the reforms that we put in place. We had 4 magnet schools and we had 6 comprehensive high schools. Every single one of those 6 comprehensive high school now has a career academy. We have a standalone vocational school because kids have choice. And they come to school because they want to be there. And those are, and we don't ratchet it down, we ratchet it up. So it makes sense to do that. We have kids now who have gotten internships, skilled trades job, and are helping to build my new schools. I have $1.6 billion to build new schools.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your question. Yes.
Hi. Just 2 points that I'd like you to elaborate on. One, this is for you, Eric. One was you were talking about teacher empowerment. Could you elaborate a little bit up on following up on John Stanford's idea to get through teacher empowerment?
And a friend of ours.
Yes. And number 2, the idea of student voices. You started by saying giving student voices. Could you elaborate on what you're doing with In a Perfect World?
That would be an excellent... Yes, thank you. General John Stanford is one of my heroes along with the Powells. And John, when you go to Seattle, John would have you have a meeting as he was arguing for tax levies. So you have to be waving at the cars and you have a meeting with him out in the streets. And they got passed. He provided the kind of dynamic leadership that I think is necessary and reinforces what Marion Bolden and other superintendents do who are really engaged. And what John did, he added to the school day to provide opportunities for professional development to occur. 4 minutes to the school day, and he got the union to agree. That added, at the end of the school year, that added a number of days so that teachers could be treated as professionals in the context of the work that we were doing. He did some other things that I think are remarkable. And one of the things that he did that he says that's a slogan that we always follow, he said, you have to love them and lead them. And that goes to the student voices. He would go to the schools, and he got the business people to give him a check. And this is one thing. I'm saying this because if there are any people here who are funders, it's a great idea when a superintendent can go into a school and reinforce not only the teachers but the school children and a principal. As John did, he would go and he'd see some great teaching. He would write out a check for them to use for instructional materials or take kids on class trips and stuff like that. We can't lose people like John. But they reside in all of us in the spirit. If we just remember and learn from the kind of interventions that they used as leaders in their district. And In a Perfect World is a remarkable effort that will... We're following the lead of our former Vice President Gore, and we're going to try to do the same thing for education that he did for environment, an important film that he created. And the film, basically, based upon the work of its founder, Manuela Testolini Nelson, we are capturing the voices of the students around, and for those who are with us in the morning, it's beautifully shot by the producer, who's Norman Klotz here. If it does not get an Academy Award nomination, it's that good to listen to these children begging you, even those who have muscular dystrophy, who are not going to live that, but who have hope, and they're in their wheelchairs, and when teachers engage with them and become leaders and listen to them and create programs for them that are supportive of their talents, the tears that are in the eyes of that child begin to dry, and a smile that will light up the world begins to appear on his or her face. So In a Perfect World is defined by just that, the voices of the students pleading with us. And when a child cries to me, as they often do in Providence, Rhode Island, or in New York City, begging for an adult to be there for them, that is where wonderful opportunities such as what the Aspen Institute, through its Ideas Festival, hopefully will begin to engender in a growing strand that recognizes, yes, the environment is important, yes, health is important, but when you go through the look at the through lines, what is it? And the PALs understand this. It's education, because that can level the playing field. One other question. Yes?
You're describing a really profoundly visionary and moving vision of comprehensive education reform, and you've just given me more hope for the public school system than I've had since I became a public school teacher 40 years ago in Harlem. My question for you relates to the broad vision of school reform. My name's Dorothy Stoneman, and I run Youth Build USA. There's a robust Youth Build program in Newark. I don't know if you know it. We provide the safe haven, the high expectations, and the mentors, and the vocational education for the young people who have dropped out across the country, the 16 to 24-year-olds who left because they didn't have a school like the ones that you're describing. And, of course, we find the same thing that you find. The society has given up on them, and yet they're brilliant, and they want to contribute, and if you give them what they need, they're great. But when we talk about school reform in this country, almost nobody ever says, and we need a second chance system, nobody says the 16 to 24-year-olds need to be brought back in, or they need their charter schools, or they need their youth build, or they need their service and conservation corps, and they need those to be just as great as what you're describing. And so my question is, have you given any thought to how the school system relates to those who've already left and those who are older, who are up to, let's say, 24? And can we work together to make sure that no child is discarded?
I love you already.
I love you too.
And we do have to fall in love with each other, rather than, so that's the only way that we're going to be able to conquer the fear that basically drives most of us in school communities across this country. And I think that what you're talking about is a recognition that no one can do it alone. And I really cringe when someone comes up with a silver bullet. Okay, it's charter schools, and we're not anti-charters. We celebrate any heroic school that's going to do great things for kids. But at the bottom line, the foundation of the American democracy is its public school educational system. And we have to find ways of breaking down those territories that separate us from reaching out, because no one can provide a panacea and a silver bullet. And in our work, we talk about partnerships. We talk about reaching out and informing each other. So we work with universities. We work with faith-based leaders. We work with mayors and elected officials and others to get them to change the tone of the dialogue or the discourse, rather than bashing the schools. Let's find ways of lifting up the spirit of an entire community. And that is when you can articulate a point of view that celebrates the work that you do in the context of a broader scheme. And we're not having that dialogue. We run for this little solution here, and then the swinging pendulum happens. We run over there. There is so much can be done if we just just begin to fall in love with each other and accept us for our individual differences and what we can bring to education reform in this country. So thank you very much for that question. And thank you very much for this opportunity to present in front of you. Thank you.